but he opened his hand to stop me. "Look, I'm sorry. I don't mean to get into that again. It was bad enough to have antagonized him when he was a guest in my home. All I mean to say is that I was unhappy then when we lived together. I felt tormented a good deal of the time." After a moment, I said, "I'm so sorry to hear that." I sipped at my coffee. "I thought of you as happy. Content, anyway. I would have said that then, I think. Content."
"Content? With what?"
"Well, you had your work. Of all the members of the house, I would have said you were the surest about that, most committed to it. And you liked the house, I thought." I set my cup down. "And we all like you well enough."
"Stop right there. Well enough. That's it, I'm afraid. Who in their right mind wants to be liked well enough?"
I laughed, embarrassed. Point taken. We sat in silence a moment. Someone had turned Muzak on low, and I was aware of it suddenly, a sprightly, violin-ridden version of Leaving on a Jet Plane. Eli said, "Do you remember this? Coming out of the living room one night and finding me in the hall?" I blushed because I was suddenly conflating this with the day I walked in on him in the bathroom. But I said, "Yes. I almost ran you down."
"See, the thing was, I was afraid to come in."
He shook his head. His voice was pitying, tender, as though he could see himself there, as though that person were his child.
"Afraid?"
"Yeah. But afraid of..." It seemed impossible to reconcile this large, gruff, nearly ebullient man with a younger Eli so frightened he couldn't enter a room of friends. He shrugged.
"How I'd fit in, or wouldn't. You were all so, well, carefree, as you say, laughing, giggling."
I snorted, stoned out of our minds, probably.
"No, here's what it was."
He raised his finger.
"I thought I would ruin it. I was afraid of having to feel the change when everyone got stiff, got polite. Having to feel my effect."
He grinned.
"What we in science would have called the Eli effect."
And then he stopped smiling. He looked down.
"What I thought was that Dana would be solicitous and sweet, and everyone else would be polite, and someone would make room for me on the couch, and then, because I was there, because of the Eli effect, the fun would dry up, for a bit, palpably, and then, as you slowly forgot about me, start again."
"You make us all sound quite horrid, all except Dana." He smiled quickly.
"Who could be horrid, too, when she wasn't being very, very good? But that's not what I mean, and you weren't. I was talking about how I felt about myself, about how paralyzed I was then, terrified, really, of any move I might make."
He was looking at me, but not seeing me. I wanted him to see me. I said, "But we all were, in some way, don't you think?" I lifted my hands. I was married. And so I couldn't really go forward with my life as a single person, which I was pretending to be. And I didn't want to be married, I knew that, but I couldn't imagine divorce, the failure of that, the ending of that life. I was raised to keep at it, whatever it was, to work harder if it wasn't going well. I smiled. "Doggedness. Doggedness is what I was raised for." He asked me then, and I told him, about where I'd come from, about my mother, my family, about the life I might have led if I hadn't run away from it. About Ted waiting for me the whole time he knew me, and how that felt. He was curious, probing. We ordered more coffee. He talked, too, about his family from a wealthy suburb north of Chicago, about being raised to believe he could do anything, have anything he wanted. He spoke of what he'd done since Lyman Street, the postdoc at Berkeley, the research fellowship at Stanford. The slow turn from chemistry to the chemistry of biology, the primacy of work in his life.
"For a long time," he said, "it was all I thought about, all I let myself think about."
He spoke of the effect of this on his relationships along the way, how they were always truncated or distorted in some sense. He mentioned a British scientist he saw every few years at conferences, a woman he went out with once a month or so for 3 or 4 years, until she finally announced that it,
whatever it was, he said, grinning,
was over. He had relaxed as we were speaking. He was slouching forward over the table now. Much, much water under the dam. Or is it over the dam, I said. I can never recall.
Whatever. You seem happy now, are you?
His hand, resting on the side of his face, pushed into the flesh by his eyes, by his cheekbone. I nodded.
Lots more than then. When you were what? The seething cauldron of angst?
He underlined the words with his tone. Well, when I was a seething cauldron of something causing angst in everyone else, anyhow. My poor ex-husband, he wasn't a bad guy either.
Are you in touch with him?
No. I heard he'd remarried, but that was years and years ago. In fact, he'd remarried twice. I knew from people who'd known us both in college. He was a dermatologist, very successful, and lived in a gated community outside Albuquerque. He had children by his third wife, children young enough to be his grandchildren.
So, you don't know if he's forgiven you?
That doesn't even matter. The issue for me was forgiving myself. And not so much because of him. In a way, forgiving myself for being alive, for being so, I guess, thoughtlessly alive. Dana made me feel that. Dana's death. He nodded.
Me too, he said.
He looked out the window, over the falling water. His mouth opened as if to speak, but then he looked at me and stopped. After a moment, he said,
And did you?
What?
Forgive yourself.
Yes, with work, mostly. It was basically my salvation. Dogs and cats, horses and cows, the odd elephant.
Elephant?
I smiled. I had a zoo internship for a couple of months in vet school.
Great,
great fun. And a feather in my cap. Of course, it was all useless knowledge in the end. How to use a 60cc syringe? I made its enormous shape with my hands. A 12-gauge needle? I laughed. I don't see anything bigger than a big dog now. But it was fun. And it made me feel I'd earned my way back to a normal life.
Yeah. That's what one does, isn't it? After hurting other people.
It sounds as though you held yourself so far away from other people that you couldn't hurt them. He laughed sharply, and then his face fell into bitter lines.
That was certainly the point, he said.
The point of what?
Of the shape of my life.
He raised his hand abruptly for the waitress, and I looked at my watch.
Lord,
I said. Daniel would be getting home in about half an hour. I stood up.
I've got to run. I had no idea how late it was.
Eli got up too, pulling out his wallet. He'd walk with me, he said. He left a tip on the table, and we crossed the empty room. The other parties had left. While we stood at the hostess stand in the entry hall, waiting for our bill, he suddenly turned to me and said,
Look, do you mind talking about this, about the past? What was, what might have been, etc., etc.?
His hand made a circle. I was getting used to it as a gesture of his.
How one forgives oneself for being who one was?
No, not at all. It's kind of special, actually, to have someone to do it with, someone who was there. The waitress appeared and Eli paid her. We went outside into the cold morning. The earlier snows had melted and the air felt dry. You could see the distant bluish line of the mountains. Our footsteps were loud in the Sunday stillness. I said,
I think, in a way, I've been wanting to talk about the past with someone. Maybe you get to a certain age and you want to, I don't know, revisit the important times in your life.
I wouldn't have said so.
We stopped now by my car, and I turned and looked at him.
But seeing you, Joe, and now talking to you,
he shrugged,
that might be true for me too.
He touched my sleeve.
I'd like to see you, to talk again.
So would I said. I'd turned away, a little embarrassed.
What?
He leaned more toward me, and I was so unnerved I took a step backward.
I'd like that,
I said.
Good. Sometime when we're not so rushed, maybe.
Yes. A slow heat was rising to my face. I hoped it didn't show. But of course, here come the holidays, and my life will be crazy for a while.
I understand. Maybe you should just call me when everything has quieted down. There's certainly no hurry about it.
I looked up at him.
No. So you'll call?
He grinned.
Eventually?
I promise.
Good. Good.
He leaned toward me, and we touched our warm cheeks together. When the girls were little, if they were distressed in the night, I was the one who went to them, who stayed until they were calm. Daniel had more trouble even waking up, and he needed much more sleep than I, so we both accepted this. For a few years, when she was around 6 or 7, Cassie, in particular, used to have nightmares. She cried out, and I would rush to her in the dark and slide in next to her. Her body would be tensed with whatever she'd imagined.
A lady was turning around, and she had big skirts on, and it was too slow, Mom. It was so slow.
I would be called from the sprint upstairs.
She was always feverishly hot, as though she'd been exercising fiercely, even in sleep.
She gave me her heated, wired body, and I gave her my large, cool one. She'd nestle against me, poking me with her sharp shoulders or bony hips, and I'd tell her stories. Over the nights, I slowly focused on a character I'd invented to give her courage, a character Cassie always wanted to hear more of, Miraculata. At first, I saw this creation as a sturdy, unflappable, older girl with a Buster Brown haircut, wearing, of course, culottes. In one story, she traveled and lived with apes in the jungles of Africa. In another, she became a fierce warrior, despite the man who said a woman couldn't do that. She was friends with animals and could understand their speech. Always a great selling point with my children. The kindly chickens and ducks gave her eggs to eat. Admiring foxes donated their tails, which they could grow back, to make a beautiful soft robe she wore in winter. Friendly elephants bathed her, sending their spray arcing high in the air. She was never afraid of them, because she knew they loved her. She was so gay, so charming. She'd begun to change already, though I hadn't planned it. She built her house herself out of snow and lived in the white glowing space, sleeping at night under a quilt she made from the down the geese had given her. At some point in these dark nights, I realized that Miraculata had changed so much now, I was thinking of Dana as the model for her, bringing Dana to life again in these reassuring fantasies, taking the person who'd met the most horrible end I knew of and making her the most fearless and invulnerable creature possible. After I understood this, I began consciously to tell Cassie some things that were true about Dana, giving details from her life to Miraculata, how she sometimes slept on the roof at night to be closer to the stars, how she made her living for a while singing in the subways. Or I would embellish a germ of truth. She was so beautiful that men painted her, drew her, and these paintings had the power to cast a spell over anyone who saw them. She gave away everything she owned, and, as a reward for that, though she hadn't expected any reward, the wood spirits replenished her supplies. She built little creatures out of clay she found on the banks of the river, and they were so beautifully made, so real, that they sometimes came to life. These two she gave away, setting them free. One night, Cassie said to me,
I know who Miraculata really is, Mom.
She was whispering as I had been, so he wouldn't wake Nora or Sadie asleep in their dark rooms across the hall.
"Do you?"
I asked. She nodded gravely, her eyes wide and black in the faint light.
"I really do."
"Who then?
Who is she?"
Shyly, she said.
"She's you."
I was pleased and even a little embarrassed to be so admired, and whenever I told her these stories afterward, I felt a special tenderness towards Cat. But then, of course, she got older and stopped needing me in the night. Several years later, though, when Cass's disaffection began, and then her rage at us at me, it helped to remember that once she thought Mira Kalotta and I were one, to know in what regard she'd held me. It helped me to understand how repulsive she found me when all of that had fallen away. "You're so limited," she said to me once when she was about 14, and I was telling her she could not do one thing or another, and I thought, well, yes, of course, I am. But at that earlier time, I realized that Cassie was right, that she'd parsed it well. Mira Kalotta was me, and Dana combined. That when I was dreaming her up in the dark with Cassie, I was talking about all the feelings I had about that time, the sense of magical possibility embodied for me in Dana's energy and passion, in the open-endedness of my own life, in the curious and momentary hallucination we all shared then. More important to me, I think, than to anyone else in the house, that we could make of our lives anything we wanted, that all the rules we'd learned growing up did not apply. We didn't know what would happen next. That was our great gift, the gift of youth. The thing we miss, it seems to me, no matter what we've made of our lives as we get older, when we do know what will happen next, and next, and next, and then last. And that is what I felt again after my coffee with Eli, that sense of a surprise, that heady sense of not knowing, that gift of a possible turn in the path. The next day, I drove into Boston to meet my mother. This had become an annual ritual since, by choice, she stayed at home for Christmas, and my brother's family came over from New Hampshire to be with her. She and I had gradually evolved what she called our early Christmas together. A meeting, an exchange of gifts, lunch, a day of shopping, and then always, before I put her back on the bus, a double martini for her and a glass of wine or coffee for me at the Copley Plaza Hotel. In the old days, I brought the girls along, and the day had exhausted all of us. For the last 4 years, though, it had been just the two of us, my mother and I, and our pace was more civilized. Our pauses were longer. She told me, when we talked the week before, that the only thing she had to get done was presents for her great-grandchildren, my brother Fred's first grandchildren, now 6 and 3. We planned to go to the Museum of Science for these. They had educational toys in their gift shop. Toys my mother believed in. Toys such as all toys had once been, it seemed to me. Things you cut or carved or assembled and glued. Things you mixed and stirred. Kites, gyroscopes, yo-yos. Nothing. And here Mother's voice on the telephone had changed, and I could imagine her drawing herself up slightly in a ladylike repulsion. Electronic. I had laughed. For beyond even her age, my mother was old-fashioned. She'd been a farm girl from the center of Maine, and she'd come to the university to work at 19 after taking secretarial courses, an ambitious reaching out for a girl of her background. By chance, she'd been assigned to my father's office. He was 20 years older than she was, a professor of botany, and he was married, though his wife was dying. My parents' love, their courtship, was never spoken of in our house. There was always a deep reticence about anything that smacked of emotion. But I imagined it later as her listening to him, admiring him, learning from him, botanizing with him, as her slowly becoming a necessity to him, this quiet country girl with a wide, surprising smile. And this seemed to me to be the nature of their love, Even long after his wife had died, and they had married, and my brother and then I had been born, each of them, solitary, busy, mostly silent, turning to the other from time to time to say things like, "Isn't that remarkable?" or "Most interesting." I think she didn't feel comfortable as a faculty wife. Perhaps she thought of it as a kind of posthumous usurpation of his first wife's role. So my father's life did not change much as a result of this new marriage, or even when he became a father two times over. My mother continued part-time as his secretary. She still accompanied him to the office each morning and went out on long walks with him. She continued to behave generally as though, like him, she were a middle-aged botanist. When he died, her grief was invisible to me, except as a kind of stiffening of further aging. She was only 44 then. She might have thought of her life as having other beginnings, other chapters anyway. She might have thought of remarriage. But within a few months, she was back at work full-time, and her life's shape seemed unaltered, as it had for all the years since. I waited for her on the bus platform at South Station. A raw wind was blowing off the ocean, and the day was heavy and grey. A motley group got off the bus when it pulled up. Some young people, a few guys in military uniforms, a fat mother with three little kids. When the driver stepped forward and held his hand out to help someone, I knew it would be Mother descending. He had made an odd motion first, as though, almost as though, he was going to take his hat off in respect. She emerged slowly, said something to him after she'd gotten down. They bent together briefly, and then leaned back, smiling in polite collusion with each other. Then she looked around quickly, ascertained which direction she should head in, and came toward me, utterly erect, white-haired, a kind of jaunty wide beret pinned on the back of her head. She had on her ancient all-purpose coat. Heavy, no-collar duck cloth, she zipped the plaid lining out of in spring. I was startled to see that on her feet she was wearing, for the first time to my knowledge, old lady shoes. Black Oxford you laced up over the instep with a thick heel. Her gait was slightly more widespread than usual, as though she was conscious of the issue of balance. I called out and crossed to her, watching her face shift as she recognized me. "Why, Josie," she said, and we held each other. We had lunch right away, in a place we usually went to, near the terminal. Despite my exclamations of interest in various dishes, she conscientiously ordered the least expensive item on the menu, as she always did, and black coffee. She asked about Daniel, about the girls, and I gave my report, offering mostly achievements and accomplishments. Not so much to boast, as because that was what I assumed would give her greatest pleasure. She offered, in exchange, information about her students, the students who boarded with her. A thin smile played over her lips as she went on about these strangers, and I was startled, as I always was, to hear how important they were to her, to feel how much more interested she was in their activities, their achievements, than in Cassie's or Sadie's or Nora's. But they, of course, were in her life every day, whereas the girls were, I suppose, a kind of lovely abstraction for her at this point, a nice idea. And I was glad, in a sense, for her involvement with Edward and Rolf and Naomi and Susie. The names changed almost yearly. Still, it was boring, too, the tedious accumulation of detail about people I didn't know and didn't care about. As she spoke, I drifted off. I watched the passers-by moving in the brisk wind outside. I looked up at the warehouse windows above us and wondered about the kinds of lives being lived there. I let myself think of Eli. "I'd like to see you again," he says, smiling at me. I smiled at my mother now, too warmly, perhaps, for she gave me an odd, sharp look, and then sniffed loudly. I asked for the check. I had read in the paper of a program of Christmas music at 2 o'clock at Trinity Church, and Mother said that would be lovely, so we drove there next. I was parking at a meter only a block or so away. We had congratulated each other on finding it, when she cried out, "Oh,
I wanted to be sure to tell you. Albert Moran died.
Dr. Moran. I turned the engine off. He came to me, bending over a wounded dog, covering it with his big hands, turning to me to say in his soft voice, "Our friend here has gone somewhere he should not have gone, I'm afraid." I saw him tidily tucking his napkin into his collar before opening his old-fashioned lunchbox, as black and humped as a steam engine.
"When?" I asked. "Oh, a couple of weeks ago, I think."
Mother was casual.
"She was used to death. It was her familiar by now."
"Had he been ill?"
"Dearie, I don't know. I just read it in the paper and thought you might like to have the information."
"I'm glad you told me.
Though come to think of it, they said he was in a nursing home, so he might have been ill. But he was 96, a good old age."
She sounded approving. This was how it should happen, the distinguished thing.
"Yes," I said.
She was opening her door.
"He was certainly good to you. I won't soon forget that."
"Nor will I," I said. The wind was driving and powerful off the glass of the Hancock building as we approached the church. Mother held her hat on with one hand, and I hooked my arm in hers as we pushed against the blast. Her coat flapped back, showing the worn lining. Inside the church, we turned away from each other, gasping in the peacefulness, the dim, reddish quiet. I blew my nose. My mother savagely repinned her hat. As we entered the nave, the lighted altar glowed, golden and radiant in the vast space. The dark wooden pews were more than half full, and we slid into the first empty one we came to. We whispered an intermittent conversation, quieted by the hush around us, by the high, empty spaces arching above. Mother was admiring of the needlepoint on the kneelers, the names of the needlewomen or their families picked out across them. Hannah Maynard Shaw, Lillian Tappan, Edward and Rebecca Soames. I was glad when the music started to sink into it, and my own thoughts, a strange mixture of Dr. Moran and my work with him, of Dana, of Eli again, and now and then of Daniel, of Mother and her curious, proud and lonely life. Did she regret it, any of it? Did she sense the end of it closing in on her, and wish she'd done things she hadn't? Wish she'd gone places she should not have gone? Or was it enough for her to have done steadily and honourably and carefully and thoroughly all the things she'd undertaken to do? Perhaps it was. My heart ached for her, suddenly. The concert closed with several carols, and Mother and I stood next to each other, sharing a hymnal. Her voice was thin and parched, but completely on key. And at one point, she ventured into a few notes of harmony against me, and we met each other's eyes and smiled. The museum was busy, though not frantic, as it sometimes was when we came. Late enough in the day so the school groups had left, we speculated. We went straight to the gift shop, and Mother started making her careful choices. A bag of cat-sized marbles, a boomerang, a kit for building a dinosaur skeleton. There was a painful kind of parsimony to all this, and I found it difficult to watch. I moved away from her. I spent some time looking at the literature they had on animal life. I was standing in the doorway watching her pay, cash. She didn't believe in credit cards. When I heard the announcement for a movie on African lions, a subject I was not without interest in, having helped raise a litter of them once when I was working at the zoo. It would give Mother a chance to rest, I thought, for she had seemed tired on the longish walk in from the parking area. "That would be very interesting," she said. And so I took her packages from her, and we bought our tickets and proceeded through the museum behind the crowd of people also headed to the movie. The theater was huge, an Omnimax, I saw. The pale beige ceiling rounded vastly over the chairs like a tepid sky. I explained to Mother the way it worked, as we sat down, as we tilted back.
"Why, it's just like going to the dentist," she said, and we both laughed.
It felt strangely intimate to be stretched out next to her. The film started above us, around us, a man's voice deep and self-important narrated. He sounded remarkably like the civic voice that had accompanied educational films of my school days. The photography was wonderful to watch. The animals with their gravity, their powerful tawny slowness, and then murderous speed. The narrative offended me, though. It was utterly spurious and imposed, involving, as it did, the repeated stumblings into danger and then rescues of the photographic group as they tried to get in close for better shots. The deep voice vibrated, trying to pump up the excitement, as though watching the animals themselves couldn't possibly be enough. At some point, I turned my head to see how all of this was affecting Mother. She lay perfectly still, her skirt carefully draped over her knees. Her old lady's shoes touched each other at the toes. She'd pulled her hands up and folded them together on her bosom, in modesty, perhaps, at lying down in public. Her mouth was slack. Her eyes had swung up to look at something at the top of the ceiling, and I could see just the glimmer of white under the iris. I suddenly realized that this was the way she would look dead. My pulse throbbed heavily, and I felt a moment of purest terror, of unreadiness. No, I thought, not yet. I leaned over her, horrified. She felt me looking. Her eyes swung to me and saw the terrible thing in my face. What? She cried out, struggling up, as frightened by me as I'd been by her. What? The hectic days passed. Sadie came home from school, slept late, often wanted the car in the afternoon. I took to driving home at lunch. She would drive me back to work and pick me up at the end of the day. I foisted errands off on her, or we did them together late in the afternoon. We had family meals again. We had loud music in the living room at night. The house would suddenly be full of her friends, and I caught up with them. Who was dropping out? Who was transferring? Who was in love? Daniel played carols at the piano, and we all sang along. My chores increased. I was never alone. My life seemed to claim me utterly in a way I would have said I was hoping for. But throughout all this, I couldn't stop thinking about Eli. I thought of the day he had bent down to touch his cheek to mine in the parking lot at the Pennock Inn, the heat he radiated physically. I thought of the way his features had thickened and even coarsened some as he'd aged, making him seem a man of appetites, energetic. What Daniel had called my crush had changed, or I felt it differently. It was no longer my past, my own youth, that attracted me to Eli. It was the thought of Eli himself, the heavy, buoyant, middle-aged man. Still, I tried to think of this as lightly as I thought of that earlier attraction, as a kind of a joke, really, one I might share with Daniel as I had the other one. But of course I didn't. I kept it private. A joke I shared with only me then. Deliberately, playfully, I fed my fantasies about Eli. I allowed them to become sexual. I gave them specific flesh. I imagine us in sundering, tearing passion in hotel rooms in Boston, in nondescript motels or inns in towns 20 or 50 miles away, laboring together, slick with sweat, sore, spent. I'd look up from addressing cards or wrapping presents or doing dishes and see Sadie slouched in a chair, her eyes unfocused, a Walkman buzzing into her ears, or Daniel reading the paper or a book, and be embarrassed at the technicolor detail of my sexual thoughts, be surprised they couldn't feel my heated distraction. It was all right to imagine this, I said to myself, my own reassuring Ann Landers, as long as I understood it wasn't going to happen. It isn't going to happen, I tell myself. And then I'd imagine another scene, another inventive coupling, another spent falling away from each other in another bed. I went further. I'd imagined Jean's death, my divorcing Daniel, or Daniel's death, Eli's divorcing Jean. Only stories, I said to myself, just that. Or they could both die, painlessly, of course. A period of mourning, Eli and I turning more and more to each other. It was all adolescent. I recognized this, and even felt some contempt for myself on account of it. It reminded me of the period in my life when I was 8 or 9 and most in love with my father. During that time, I repeatedly imagined my mother's dying in a variety of ways, and my father stepping into her role, caring for my father, becoming his sine qua non, his necessary. And now I told myself that this, all this days of imaginary flesh I lived in, was as little connected to what was going to happen, to what I truly wanted, as that had been. But what I was wondering was, what I truly wanted. And what if Eli wanted an affair? What if he pressed for that? Would I resist? I had certainly had temptations in the past, a number of mild, pleasurable flirtations, and twice moments when I felt I was actively, and even perhaps reluctantly, choosing not to succumb to something that both compelled and frightened me. Once, only a few years earlier, at a conference of small clinic vets in Hawaii, I'd been drawn to a vet from Seattle named Davis Holliston, a rumpled, cheerful, profane man, kind and sexy, a master teller of jokes. He only had to start, "A duck walks into a bar," and I would be convulsed. Night after night, we sat up late drinking and talking and laughing with the others, and then finally, it was just us, and I had to decide. And once, much earlier, we'd hired a man older than our usual high school student, a man in his 20s, as an assistant in the clinic. I was in my mid-30s, just starting at the practice then, swamped with work and small children and the demands of the house which we'd recently moved into, each room of which was a project waiting to be undertaken. Decaying, water-stained wallpaper, linoleum flooring, obsolete, exposed pipes running from floor to ceiling. To be reminded, as I was one night when we stayed on together and he hesitatingly, then authoritatively, then wildly kissed me, that I was sexual, that I was still young, that I was attractive, even in my scrubs, my grubby sneakers. This was a revelation, an awakening, a thrill, a temptation. I resisted it. I broke away. I wept. I clung to him. I wept some more. I went home and confessed my feelings to Daniel. For days we made time for each other. We talked passionately about our life together and what we needed to do to make it more intense, more loving again. I had to fire Eric. He said he understood. We stood glumly opposite each other in one of the exam rooms, the moat of the gleaming stainless steel table separating us, and talked about it, about my life, my responsibilities, about Daniel, about Eric's life, about what he would do next. I told Beattie I'd had to fire Eric because he'd been repeatedly late for the morning opening. "Is that so?" she said at the time. And then some days later, "You did the right thing, letting Eric go." "Thanks," I said, not looking at her. "Yes, he was too forward for my taste." I could feel her eyes sharp upon me, hoping for confidence, a confession, some dirt. But I kept my own counsel, mine and Eric's and Daniel's. This was it, my history. I assumed Daniel's was something like it, though he hadn't ever spoken to me of his attraction to anyone. But perhaps he'd had to say to someone what I said to Davis in Hawaii as he leaned in the doorway to my hotel room, that I'd always assumed about myself that I'd be faithful in marriage. "Ah," he said then, sounding approving and deflated at once. I had assumed that. I assumed it still. But it seemed to me now that there might be circumstances so compelling, so out of the ordinary run of the possible that the old rules, the old feelings, would no longer apply. The truth was, I didn't know what I would do if I had the choice, and that, too, made me feel distant from Daniel, from my daughter, from what was normally a joyous period of preparation. Cass and Nora arrived on Christmas Eve from opposite directions and in time for all of us to go to the 10 o'clock service together. Daniel was already at church, so we piled into my car. Nora and Cass were being civil to each other, having a gingerly discussion in the back seat about a band Nora had heard recently in New York, the Little Piggies. The night was wonderfully clear, and when we got out of the car at church, Sadie and I leaned back dizzily in the frigid air and tried to identify the few constellations we knew in the glowing sky. Cass and Nora danced around us, calling out invented names to hurry us along.
"Why, it's the Little Piggies themselves! Look, look! The Jolly Green Giant!
And there's Paterfamilias!
Check it out,
the Lederhosen over here! The Alma Mater!
Come on, you guys, let's go!"
Inside, the church smelled of wool, of candles, of the pine boughs that decorated the altar, and of something vaguely like cinnamon. The service was short, just scriptures and carols, and a quick homily from Daniel. The children's choir did a descant in their piercing, clear voices on the last hymn, and it brought unexpected tears to my eyes. At home, we had hot cider with rum, and opened one stocking gift each, the beginning of our prolonged ritual. There were lumpy purple mittens for Sadie from Beatty. "She made them herself," I said. A new fishing lure for Daniel, bath oil for me, a tiny moonstone earring or nose ring or eyebrow ring for Cass, a pair of tortoiseshell combs for Nora's heavy hair from Sadie. Daniel was especially energetic and happy. He kept putting extra logs on the fire, stirring it. He sang to himself as he got us all more cider and cookies. It was the end of a long, demanding season for him, and he had 3 days with not a lot to do before the Sunday service. I went to bed early, but he said he wanted to sit up a while with the girls. As I passed through the hall on my way back from the bathroom, I could hear them in the living room, a burst of laughter, and then Nora's voice.
"If you strain for a compliment, and I had to, believe me, you might have called it cinema verite, but it was really just plain home movies."
"Down home movies, it sounds like," Daniel said. And then I heard his loose, light laugh, and I shut the door.
When I woke in the morning and turned to his side of the bed, the bedclothes lay rumpled and empty. Daniel was gone. The house was silent around me. I had an odd moment of fear, and then I realized he'd gotten up early and gone to church alone. He often did this on Christmas Day, beginning it in solitary prayer, before he came home to our loud and secular festivities. I imagined him there now, sitting with his eyes intently closed in a pew in the chilly nave, the gentle morning light falling on his solitary figure, on the white painted pews, the grey floors. How sad it was, really, I thought, lying there, that not one of us shared his belief, that he was so alone in this central aspect of his life. Did we even have beliefs, I wondered. I believed in animals, I supposed, their purity, their goodness. Cass believed in music and cigarettes and coffee and wine and men. Nora believed in getting up early and starting each day carefully dressed, carefully made up. And Sadie? Maybe Sadie still believed in us. By the time I heard Daniel's car crunching over the frozen snow in the yard, I was up and dressed. I'd fed the dogs and let them out. I'd made coffee and started stuffing for the goose. Daniel burst in at the door, and I heard him stomping, sniffing, hanging up his coat and shedding his boots in the back hall. When he came into the steamy kitchen, his cheeks were flushed. His hair was raked up oddly from his hat. He looked like a badly cared-for child. His face lifted when he spotted me. He cried out, "Merry Christmas, my darling, my dearest, my sweet." And he crossed to embrace me. His face was cold, bristly. His nose was wet. "Oh, Daniel," I said. I kissed him lightly. "Why pull away? Why, when I adore you so?" "Do you?" I asked, embarrassed. I reached out and flattened his hair. "An alternative, just a suggestion," he said. He raised his finger as though about to conduct an orchestra. "And I adore you, my dearest husband."
"Well, of course I do," I said. "Come and sit, and I'll pour you some coffee."
We sat down opposite each other at the table. Sunlight had just begun to flicker through the kitchen windows, shifting with the motion of the pine trees behind the house as it edged above them.
"Oh,"
I remembered, setting my cup down.
"I had a weird dream."
"Visions of sugar plums?"
"No,"
I smiled, "no." And then I thought better of telling him.
"Actually, I can hardly remember it."
But I did. It was a dream that was familiar to me, though it took various forms. Usually, I was still married to my first husband, or Daniel, in some way, was Ted. This time, it had been in a strange, messy house, unrecognizable, and Ted, stroke Daniel, kept starting to make love to me, sliding his hand deep into my pants, touching me. I'd woken in the night feeling aroused, bigamous. "I like it when I can't quite remember dreams," Daniel said. "When I feel my brain has its own private life that I don't necessarily have access to."
"But if you worked at it, you could reach them. Freud said so."
"Does he?"
Daniel said.
"Well, the hell with Freud, I say. I say, let the secret life be the secret life."
I laughed and raised my coffee cup.
"Hear, hear."
He reached over to pat my leg.
"There, there," he said.
Then we both got up, he to shave, I to finish the stuffing and to prepare our big family breakfast. As I sailed the folded white cloth into the air and it bellied out over the table, it caught the first sure shafts of sunlight falling into the room and sank dazzlingly down, like the descent of a blessing, I thought, and I willed myself to record it, to remember. Early that afternoon, after we'd unwrapped the presents and put the dinner in the oven to cook, Daniel took me ice skating. We hadn't gone in several years, but they'd just flooded the town green and the ice was new and smooth. I was not a good skater, Daniel was, and he glided around and around the edge of the ice, a slim, boyish figure at this distance, bent low, stroking steadily, easily crossing one foot over the other as he swept around the curves. I pushed my slow way up and back, stopping every few trips to rest my sagging ankles and tense legs by sitting on the wooden bench at the edge of the ice. From here, I could see the front of the Congregational Church, and behind it, modestly peeping around its corner, our house, in its regularity, like a picture of old New England. Smoke puffed from the chimney. We'd left the sleepy, sated girls still in their bathrobes by the fire. At last, Daniel skated up to me with a flourish of sprayed ice.
"Shall we?" he said,
and opened his arms to receive me. I slid forward, and he took my hand in one of his and put his arm around my waist. We pushed off, and after a few faltering steps, I got his rhythm. I began to lean with him, now this way, now that. Daniel powered us, his legs pumping hard, his arm around me transferring his strength to me, giving my strokes length and reach. We rode across the smooth, gleaming ice under the bare maple branches, up toward the church with its long, pointing steeple, back toward the houses facing it, their doors hung with festive wreaths, Christmas lights twinkling in a few windows. The wind we generated stung my nose and cheeks, but I was exhilarated. Up and back we went, leaning steeply into the curve at each end. I felt young and strong. I felt I could have gone on like this forever, with just the sound of the rushing air and the skate blades slicing the ice, so that when Daniel let go of my hand and dropped back away from me to skate off again, I wasn't ready for my own sudden heaviness, the stump-like thickness of my limbs. I stopped dead in the middle of the gunmetal pond. Daniel danced by me, running, leaping, now that he was free of my dragging weight. He was showing off, spinning as he passed, landing on one skate, bending balletically. I felt lumpen, old and stiff. I turned around and around in the center of the pond, watching him circle me, full of a childish rage at him, but also wanting to call him back, to stop him, to ask somehow for his help.
Chapter 11.
Can you have a drink? Eli asked. Are you driving back this afternoon?
I'm not sure, I said. What I told Daniel was that I was meeting Lauren Ho, a friend from Maine, and might spend the night if it got too late.
I may stay over. In any case, yes, a drink.
He raised his hand, a peremptory gesture I saw, authoritative, a gesture that assumed. It excited me, this small thing, the way in adolescence seeing a boy's big hands on the steering wheel of a car had excited me. Something about their power, their control over my situation, over my life. Something foolish, even willfully foolish. The waiter came and took our order. We were sitting by the tinted window in the bar of the Ritz Hotel in Boston. On the crowded sidewalk outside the plate glass, pedestrians hurried past, huddled against the cold. The public garden loomed dark and mysteriously beautiful across the street. There had been skaters on the frozen duck pond when I got out of the car, and tinny waltz music floating thinly in the darkening air.
I'm glad you called, he said.
I am too. Though I had felt almost frightened by the sight of him in the doorway, his face questioning the waiter, and then opening in what seemed like pleasure as he saw me across the dimly lighted room. I'd been meaning to for a while, I said, but life's been chaotic, as I predicted.
A nice chaos, though, as I imagine it.
It was fun, but it was a relief when everyone left. Sadie had gone back to school just 3 days earlier, after a long holiday break.
I'm sure.
The drinks came, and we wordlessly raised our glasses to each other. In the corner, the group of men in dark suits suddenly laughed loudly. My bourbon tasted smoky and thick. Eli had begun to talk, speaking of the pleasure of being in the lab again. He'd come from there to meet me, of getting things set up. He said he had stayed late in town twice the week before. He talked about the seductive quality of the solitude, about how he'd always loved the lab at night. He shook his head.
Finally, there's nothing like work, is there? He said.
I was thinking of him as a young man, the worker bee we'd nicknamed him. I smiled. I can't imagine a life without it, I said. Retirement, doesn't that seem improbable? He agreed.
Impossible, in fact, he said.
He spoke of a restless irritability that had overtaken him at some point late in the fall, like something physical,
like a nervous disorder. In spite of the fact that I was doing kind of work, dashing around lecturing and attending conferences, it's not the same, though.
I sympathized. I talked about the way I felt walking into the clinic, about the sense I sometimes had of being lifted out of ordinary life, of leaving it behind. Of course, it's different in my work, I said. There is no solitude. I mean, I have the animals with their own personalities and lives, their own life stories, really. He smiled.
I suppose, he said. Sure, Arthur had one after all. For me, though...
He paused, looked out the window a moment.
For me, work has been my life story, I think.
He was speaking more slowly than usual, and without that lightness in tone which normally undercut the possibility of seriousness in whatever he was saying, or perhaps a kind of substitute for a life story. I think of myself as a scientist first, before I'm a man, really. That's why I think... Well, when I spoke to you about Jean, about our separateness, that's why that's so important to me, because it frees me for what's most central. He looked sharply at me. I've tried to make my life count, and I think I have. I think, honestly, that the world is a better place because of the work I've done, and that's everything to me. I smiled. Why? Because this was grandiose, but also, I think, high-minded. I wasn't used to such shameless high-mindedness. Daniel avoided it. I suppose because high-mindedness combined with piety is such a deadly combination. He saw the smile.
You think I'm being immodest? He accused. I'm not, I assure you.
Crossing this blood-brain barrier is pivotal, absolutely pivotal, to curing all kinds of diseases. He lifted his hands and began to count them off, finger by finger. Cancer, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, even spinal cord injuries. All of them will have treatments eventually, soon. Some do already, but no way of getting them across the natural blockade in the brain. And he began carefully to explain to me the applications of his work, its importance in various of these treatments. It made me think of the night when he'd explained his research to me on Lyman Street, and of my sense then of seeing a different Eli. The Eli he'd become, I thought, watching him now. The Eli he'd grown into. He was talking about the impenetrability of the capillaries in the brain, their lack of porousness, what he called the tight junctions between cells. He talked about some other approaches for getting drugs across, temporarily shrinking the cells lining the capillaries so the drugs could, for a short period of time, pass through, or surgically implanting them.
But the most efficient way, the way that will help the maximum number of people and will have application with the maximum number of drugs, is what we're trying to do with nerve growth factor. Essentially, it's like smuggling it across, he said. You get a molecule that's allowed to cross, one with its own transport system, and you ask it to be your mule, he grinned, to carry along the molecule you want to get in there.
It seemed of great importance to him that I understand all this, and so I took care to be sure I did. The exchange was, for me, exciting in part intellectually, but also in part because I sensed he might be wooing me with this. At one point, he actually took his pen out and drew on a napkin the way the transport proteins ferried substances across from the bloodstream to the brain cells waiting outside the capillaries. The black ink trembled and blotted on the soft paper. I was aware of the beginning of a kind of physical restlessness in myself, an eagerness that was not yet fully sexual but could be, I could tell. I was titillated by Eli's seriousness, by his clarity about his work, by the work itself, truly. What else? By his reference again to the separateness in his marriage, even by the way he spoke my name as he explained things. So it seemed somehow an interruption in everything when he suddenly sat back, looking at me intently and said,
"Do you mind if we talk about Dana?"
Then I realized that, of course, this was part of our intimacy, too. Of course we would. When I first thought about seeing him again, when Jean brought Arthur to me, that was exactly what I'd assumed we'd speak of sooner or later. Dana. The past. Who we were then. No, I said, no, I'd like that. This will slow us down, I thought. Yes, let's slow down. Nothing has to happen, nothing. It's wonderful to think of having someone to talk about her with, actually, after all this time. He looked out the window for a long moment, and then at me, with an expression on his face I couldn't read. He said, "Did you know she and I had been lovers?" Yes. Dana told me that, did she?
He seemed momentarily surprised. Well, she told everyone everything, didn't she?
He shook his head fondly.
She was the second woman I'd slept with in my meager sexual life of the time. I was terribly in love with her.
That I didn't know.
No one did. Including Dana, strangely enough.
So you just, what, sat on it? Kept it secret?
No, no. I tried to tell her. I did tell her. That's the strangely enough part. Because in some sense, she didn't hear me.
She wouldn't hear me.
She was a very powerful person in some ways, you know. What she wanted for us was to be friends, just plain old friends. That's how she thought of us. So, he made a face, that's what we were.
His hands were cradling the squat glass his drink had come in, sliding it a few inches back and forth across the tabletop.
It was she who brought me into the house. Did you know that?
I shook my head.
Yes, he nodded. And at first, foolishly, I thought it was another kind of invitation.
He smiled his self-mocking smile.
This was after you were lovers or before?
I was confused.
When exactly were you lovers?
He laughed, and I could feel my face lift in response.
Yes, he said. Let me tell you my story. I guess I do have a story after all.
A complicated story, in fact.
He sipped from his drink and set it back down. He'd met her, he told me, at the Peabody Museum. He felt so socially awkward at that stage of his life that he ate there regularly in order to avoid having to eat or talk to anyone from his lab or his department. Dana was there one day, moving behind the glass cases, a beautiful, tall woman with thick blonde hair reaching halfway down her back. She was alone, sketching the animals, their strange skeletal structures.
The slow loris, he said, with a peculiar emphasis.
The honey possum.
I smiled again. I'm not sure why. She saw him watching her. She waved to him. He imitated her gesture, a slow curling in of separated fingers. A day or two later, she was there again, and she came up to him this time, and they talked. She talked, he said.
I was overwhelmed.
She said if he came here often for lunch, she'd see him again. That's when she usually came in, too. And so she did. Once. Twice. And by the next week, she'd invited him back to the house with her, and they'd made love in her room. He paused, watching his hands move on the glass again.
I don't know that she was much interested in her own pleasure. My later experience tells me she might not have been.
He looked up at me.
But she loved giving pleasure in ways that were to me then astounding, he grinned. And even now, thinking back, certainly most accomplished. But she wanted, I think, to be amazing. I don't know. She wanted to do everything every time. To use up all of herself, all of you. To a person like me, he lifted his hands. I hadn't known such feelings could exist. I stopped being able to work, which for me,
he shook his head.
I became obsessed. I would say temporarily deranged, in fact.
He smiled sadly. For a few weeks they met daily, he said, sometimes several times a day. She came to the lab once at night, and they made love on a counter, and then in a closet after they heard someone in the corridor. They made love fully clothed, Dana astride him, on a bench in the Cambridge Common.
And then?
His hand made a gesture of explosion, of vanishing.
She met someone else, and I must suppose was busy about the very same things with him.
His voice exaggerated the pronunciation of these words. His smile was ironic.
And quite finished with me, he said.
That must have been hard, I said, to have someone like Dana quite finished with you.
Yes, he agreed.
And yet, she wasn't actually. No, not quite, because she still wanted to be friends, to have coffee, to talk, to go to a movie with me sometimes.
Each time she called, he said, his hopes would rise. And then he'd feel foolish, exposed, but also crass, in the wrong somehow. That he'd expected anything more than her sweetness, her company. He said that her inviting him to join the house was the last straw. After he moved in and realized that nothing was going to change between them, they had a terrible fight, a scene in which he accused her of tormenting him deliberately. She wept freely. She was astonished, sympathetic. Didn't he know she was involved with Duncan?
No, he said.
And I told her. I wouldn't have believed it anyway.
He shook his head.
That self-satisfied jerk.
I laughed, and he smiled back fleetingly. He said the scene went on for a while. He was accusatory. She kept calling him darling, honey. She held him. He'd wept, finally,
for the first time since I was a kid.
After this, she came to his room occasionally if he seemed upset. Once or twice, she actually tried to jerk him off or suck him off, as though he said it was just a physical pressure he was feeling. One